Hi, I'm Andalisi.
And I'm Chef James Regalo.
And in this episode of Essential Cooking, we sit down with Chef John Vermiglio to talk about his time working in Chicago as a chef, as a young chef, for Charlie Trotter. And then we end up talking about the documentary about Charlie Trotter's life.
Charlie Trotter is one of the most famous chefs to ever emerge out of the Midwest landscape. He ran his flagship restaurant, Charlie Trotter's, in Chicago for well over two decades, from the 80s and into the early 2000s.
John spent a lot of time in Chicago working in Charlie Trotter's world, if you will. And then, of course, he came back to Detroit.
He did. We broke down his time with Charlie and then the chefs he met there and where he worked while in Chicago, why he moved back, and the impact he's made since. Well, today we have world-famous chef John Vermiglio of Grey Ghost, Bassan, Second Best. You're called Four Man Ladder Group, but not a lot of people know that. I don't really, you know, leading advertising with Four Man Ladder Group, but that's what your company's called.
That is correct.
Grey Ghost has become, a cornerstone of the neighborhood for sure in Midtown. But I mean, you spent a considerable amount of time in Chicago, and I don't think many people know that, or then maybe they know you moved back. But while you were there, you worked for some pretty serious chefs. So I want to start today talking about, you know, Memory Lane with John Vermiglio. Where did you first work when you went to Chicago?
Well, I started in a law firm, actually.
A law firm?
Yeah. I had this idea that post-graduation I would live this dream of cooking for a living, but also having a life. So I worked from like 7 a.m. until 3, catering for some lawyers. And about 2 months in, I realized the soul-sucking nature of that and switched gears. So, and old enough now to have seen a advertisement in the want ads of the newspaper for a position at Trotter's To Go in Chicago.
I was going to say, so that was 2 months into Chicago.
Yeah.
You start working for Charlie Trotter.
Yeah.
And I wanted to talk about Charlie Trotter today because that documentary just came out, Love Charlie, streaming on Amazon. I'm a fan of Charlie's work. Obviously, he's got a pretty notorious reputation. I only ever dealt with him as a customer. I was pretty young when I ate there. But, I mean, if you watch that documentary, it really is a beautiful movie. I mean, they did a great job making that film. And kind of, I feel like they capture a lot of what the good and the bad about our industry, right? How a chef loses their mind, basically. And you can kind of see him always on the cusp of, like, boiling over. And then I think, you know, obviously with his early death, you know, you almost saw some moments where you're like, you know, you could see where he could be salvaged or rescued or kind of come back to earth. But I mean, the 25 years of just 3 Michelin level pursuit, it'll kill you.
Yeah.
And it killed him. So, and you spent time with him directly as his chef assistant. What was your title?
I guess I was hired in as the executive sous chef of Trotter's To Go, which was his like retail outlet. He had like a little specialty grocery shop and then prepared food section. And that was his sort of way of connecting with, you know, the next tier down of people that were wanting to spend the money to go
get a little taste, but you can't maybe afford to dine.
It wasn't cheap, that's for sure. but yeah, right in the heart of Lincoln Park, and it was great. It was a lot of neighbors popping in for, you know, we would portion out salmon and sear it off, so you just got to bake it. I mean, honestly, we were ahead of the COVID game.
So I mean,
we were already ahead of the game.
Jumping ahead, you probably borrowed some stuff.
I was
COVID. You probably were borrowing some memories.
No question. I was ready to go on that. So yeah, we were tagging a lot of stuff and, you know, prepared and ready to go. And then we used that as the hub for the catering aspect of the restaurant. So that's where I was really getting the connection. And when I interviewed with them, they were like, you know, they wanted to make sure that I wasn't interviewing for that job so that I could get a job at Trotter's, the restaurant. And, you know that like, I knew who Charlie was, but I didn't really understand who he was. And I also was so naive to the entire world of fine dining because I wasn't in it. Red Lobster was like, we made it. You know, that was
Had you eaten at his restaurant before you started working there?
No. Actually, to this day. Well, you can't now, but only yeah. one time. Really? I only ate there one time. Yeah.
So. While you worked there or after you had left?
While I worked there, yeah. He allowed me to invite my staff in from the catering company to one of his excellence dinners, okay. which was these dinners he would throw, you know, a lot of the times philanthropically for, you know, whether it was a group of teachers from the Chicago Public Schools or children from the neighborhood. And they were this excellence dinner. And that was like his big overarching theme of the way he operated in life, really, and yeah. obviously the restaurant. So basically they would spend the entire time, you know, serving the normal meal that you would get. And it was in the studio kitchen where he filmed his TV shows. So just big one big table. And every course they'd come out, talk about the wine, the food. And then one of the team members would talk about what excellence was and sort of what it meant to them. Hmm. And this would happen all the time. And so I, you know, we sat there and it was like, you know, you're having this incredible meal, but you never got the chance to like
talk.
Soak it in because we just nonstop talk every course. And we're like, excellence is this, you know? But it was like, you were so inspired at the same time, or at least I was. I know there was some people that like cranked out sandwiches for me that were like, why'd you bring us here, chef?
Did he design the menus at every step of the way? Like everything that you did was that you executed, was it all his stuff?
No, it was me.
Was it? Oh, that's
interesting.
Yeah,
it was me. And I mean, at the time I came around, the restaurant was into year 16 or 17. Mm-hmm. So they were pretty far in.
Right.
So Charlie had already, you know, sort of ascended the ladder of his own hierarchy. So there was a brigade of chefs underneath him. So we just, they kind of left me alone, I guess, which was crazy to me because I was 21 years old and like I had never even worked in a restaurant like fine dining at all. You know, I felt like I conned my way in there for once, which probably doesn't happen very often now, my culinary degree was like, it held so much weight. And I was like, all right, that 100,000 was worth it. They were so shocked that I was like not trying to find a roundabout way to get into the restaurant to work. Because everyone would just take the job at Trotter's to go and then just be like, let me move over to the restaurant. Mm-hmm. Let me move to the restaurant. And it was like, you know, I was terrified of that joint. You know, I would have to go pick things up. And I was like, absolutely petrified to go in.
Who was the CDC when you were there?
Matthias Merges. Okay. Yeah.
And Matthias was the chef you basically worked for right before coming to Detroit.
Yeah. I would log him as my mentor. He was with Charlie for 15 years. And he left about a year after I left. And then brought me into his restaurant group and then I, you know, he was going to give me a restaurant and I was like, give me all of them. And we opened a bunch of spots together. So, I mean, without question, that start at Trotter's is like, why we're sitting right here.
So did he eat the food you made? Do you know?
Very rarely did he eat the food that I made. He would come through and like taste things on occasion.
Right.
But most of what he did when he came to the to-go spot was shop. He would shop for his house then he would go home and eat it. And then he would just send emails to my bosses and be like, hey, this shouldn't be like this. It shouldn't be like that. And it was like a game for him in terms of like making sure we were always at the utmost preparedness. So he was the guy at 7:59 showing up when we close at 8. And it's like, if you didn't, you know, if it didn't look good.
And you never knew when he was going to show, right?
Well, we wouldn't know what time, but we would get about a 3-minute heads up, which is the distance between the restaurant and the to-go spot. Uh-huh. And there was a phone in the kitchen of the restaurant and then one in the kitchen at the to-go spot. So they would call and they'd be like, chef's on his way. Yeah. And then you would, you know, try and make it look as tidy as you could in 3 minutes and then hope for the best that he came in there. So
how long were you with Trotter?
3.5 years. Yeah. Which was a little longer than I anticipated. Cause when I tried to leave, he's like, no, that's not going to happen. And I was like, okay.
How does that conversation go though? Like what did he say to you? Like that?
Well, because, you know, I was still, again, intimidated by the dude. And he let me into his world, which was mind boggling to me. And I was like, your perfect little soldier, right? Like I was willing to put in all the work in the world. I was making my opening, offer when they offered me the job, which was like shocking to me. And I was also wildly hungover for the interview, so I was shocked at it that it happened. And the day of the interview, we sat down, they talked it over with me. I said blah blah blah, and then Chef Matthias was like, "Okay, what are you doing today? You know, and it's Saturday. I was working Monday through Friday, living that good life. I'd gone out Friday night, and I'm like, I got to pull it together for an hour for this interview, and then back to sitting on my ass. Yeah. And so he's like, "What are you doing? You know?" And I'm like, I don't have any plans for him. He's like, "All right, I'll see you at the restaurant in an hour." You know? And I'm like, "What?" And in a lot of regards, it was the best thing that could have happened because I didn't have any time to absolutely panic.
Freak out and everything.
Like, I did freak out for 1 hour.
Yeah.
And I went home and I ironed my uniform. And I'm like trying to sharpen my knives, and you know, I don't want to be late. And I worked a 15-hour shift that day
for day one.
Wow.
Yeah, and I hadn't even. It was just the stash. They didn't even give me the job, and I was dying. I was hungover as all hell. But of course, you're like, this is my shot.
What was the offer?
So opening offer. And they call me, right? I'm walking through the streets of Chicago. I'm like, we're gonna see what's going on today. And they call me, and I'm like, my heart's pounding, kind of like when you drive by the cops and you're like, and so $24,000 was my offer. And I was going to be, the executive sous chef, but there was no one above me. They sent me mentors, but there was no, I was the guy, I was running the kitchen. So $24,000, and I'm like, okay, I'm going to call you back. You know, and I'm in Chicago, I'm new, I don't have any money because I spent it all on college. So I'm like, I got to budget it out. And I look up the poverty line, right? I'm like, all right, let me see what this is. So I muster up the courage to go back and say this is, and I'm not talking to Charlie himself, but the message is going right to him. So thank God I was naive because there's no, even right now I'd be like petrified to say that to him. I went back and I said, hey, it's really low. It's gonna be really tight to live off of that. Poverty line's at like 28,000. Like, do you think there's any wiggle room? And he's like, okay, hold on. We'll talk to Charlie, and then there's some silence for a while. And he comes back. He's like, okay, we're prepared to offer you $24,500. And I was like, you can keep the 500. So I took it for 24.
Wow.
I refused it. I said, no, never mind. I'll take it for 24 and let's go. And about a year in, I received at the time, at least as it was told to me, the largest raise that he had ever offered up because I was so grossly underpaid. And then I just instantly was like all in, 120 hours a week. And I was terrified. I didn't even know how to clean a fish. And I'm like the chef of this thing. And I'm running this catering company for him that I had worked at a catering place for 2 months. So it was like
grossly unprepared.
But that's
also I think why it worked. I think anybody that had more experience would be like, this is insane, I can't do this,
right?
And move
they
on.
Would have never wanted to deal with it because when there was an event, which wasn't always the case, or a lot of the events were or a fair amount of them until they started to trust me came out of the restaurant because they would want the 12 course degustation menu that they knew Charlie for. And it wasn't like I could just rip that off out the rip there. Yeah.
This is for both of you. Why was he so good?
I mean, I think I recommend watching the documentary to anybody listening. It really captures.
It's called Love Charlie.
It's called Love, comma Charlie.
It's kind of the rise and fall of Charlie.
It's based on letters and you watch him. And it's so cool because you watch him becoming what we know, what the world knows him as. And then you kind of watch him, boiling over. So you really can see this special moment in time where he was as good as you have heard. And I mean, his books, I think that's kind of he basically was one of the first dynamic modern day celebrity chefs. You have Julia Child and you have your, famous first chefs, but he really did it all. I mean, he had the books, he had the celebrity tour, he had the cooking show, he had the to-go line. I mean, the 3 Michelin stars forever. He was, the tenured chefs. I mean, the all-star team that he had inside the kitchen.
I'm going to correct you there. Only 2 Michelin stars.
Oh, you're right. I'm sorry. He only had 2.
Yeah, I think it was only 1, maybe 2 years that the guy showed up in Chicago before the restaurant.
That's right.
Closed.
That's right. That's
but
right.
Yeah, no, it's right. Big to do that he did not get.
No. You're right. I misspoke. Yeah. Thank you for correcting me because yeah. You are correct. Because Michelin was late to Chicago, but it was basically the unspoken three Michelin star restaurant between New York and L.A. I mean, it was often called the only reason to stop. You know, to land an airplane between New York and L.A.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, no, you're totally right. I totally misspoke. We should edit that out. But I no, never misspeak. Everyone, it's impossible.
Everyone thought that it was going to happen.
No, you're right. And like, that's in an Alinea.
They really rocked the world.
So when Alinea got, yeah. But yeah. It was really Charlie. It was really the books, the experience, the wine team. I mean, if you read Lessons in Excellence, I think anybody can really extract a ton of value from that book. I mean, it's designed for anybody that just wants. It's basically Kaizen, like the philosophy of constant improvement. And it's very, I mean, I've read that a bunch, passed it out, bought it for people. It mm-hmm. still holds up. I mean,
yeah.
So yeah, I mean, it's really, he's a dynamo or was a dynamo, but you watch in the movie, I think he definitely, I mean, there's a lot of toxicity. The way he treated people was terrible, you know, especially his staff. The staff got it the worst, but.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of mind games, and not in a bad way necessarily, but you know, he was a really big reader and he was really into like psychology and philosophy, and so it was almost like you felt like he was ahead of you, like he was already thinking what you should be thinking, and then he would ask you questions and prod you in ways that would make you think that way and react the way that he would want you to react. But you know what, all that James said is absolutely right. And he is like, you know, no one was doing it. 1987 is when the restaurant opened and nobody was doing a degustation menu. You know, it was a thing that he had seen when he went to study, and he came from some money. And so he was afforded the opportunity to travel. So he, once he committed to cooking, like he just, it engulfed his entire life.
Well, like it's not unlike your story though, where like you didn't just go and like line grind for 5 years, you know, in someone's kitchen and like climb through the ranks. You kind of had an unconventional start because like you said, you know, right out of college, you basically take a executive sous chef to a to-go catering event space to a very famous chef. Like that's not a traditional job for a young chef. And then, you know, I think that like Charlie, and Charlie didn't work under somebody incredible and climb through the ranks and then open his own restaurant. He basically went and almost had like a power stage, like just went out and just worked at a bunch of places for a short amount of time and then came back and opened his restaurant, which is not, that's not really suggested by the industry at large. You know, I think we kind of frown upon it. You know, when you hire people, you're like, oh, you should work here for a couple of years. Or you tell your cooks, hey, after you leave, you know, you should go work for somebody great. Go to New York and stick it out for a few years. Like Trotter was like staging, power staging, coming back and then opened up one of the most impactful restaurants in the Midwest ever. I mean, I don't think there's even a second place in the Midwest for a restaurant like that.
He didn't go to culinary school, did he? I thought he was self-taught.
I
think he was self-taught.
He has a college degree from somewhere, but yeah. It's not in cooking.
It's not in cooking. Yeah. It's,
but yeah, I mean, I don't want to sensationalize, you know, who he was as a, you know, he's like, you know, all is forgiven because he was a talented guy. Definitely.
But like, I mean, your restaurant does what he does. Like in a way, you're getting away with what you can do at Mabel Gray because of him.
That's a great point. Yeah. I mean, basically,
he brought the tasting menu to people. He brought the idea. I mean, he was living it in what the culinary world is now then.
Yeah.
Like 1987, we were still crushing Jell-O with like walnuts in the middle of it, you know? So it was like, then he's showing up and he's putting all this stuff on there. No one knows what the heck's going on. And he's just blowing minds because it was just so incredible and it was so new and fresh, and like there was other chefs doing it, don't get me wrong, and mm-hmm. in France it was, you know, par right. for the course,
yeah, and
but
and,
in America we didn't see it that way.
And Farmer Lee will say that he basically like invented the microgreen, you know. He was like one of the first chefs to basically like say, hey, snip it there when it's tiny and let's use that as a garnish
he
or as a part of the dish.
Sous vide cooking,
yeah,
that was a big thing for him, that, you know, he sort of revolutionized or he, you know, he didn't invent it, but he got the privilege. We had him. We had the original one that looked like a boat motor from the 40s. So yeah, it really, he was ahead of his time, and he was in a city where you could do it, and it had you know, the audience that he could get away with it. And then yeah, he had TV shows and cookbooks. Yeah. And so.
So as cooking changed, and he pretty much set a bar for himself that was so high. I mean, and to be able to stay at that level for a long time, I'm no chef, but it seems like a tall order and something to really, you have to really work for. Was he able to stay ahead of everyone else? Was he able to stay at the level that he had set and that everybody sort of looked to him too? I mean, there's that as well. Like, he influenced so many people. So as his career, you know, moved along, how did he fit into sort of the world he created, I guess is what I'm asking.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, that's kind of been well documented that Grant Achatz is probably one of the most famous chefs to ever intersect with Charlie Trotter. I think he worked there for a short period of time and kind of had a bad experience with them. And Trotter was notorious for torturing you if you left. You basically were banned. Like, you're like, you're dead. You're dead to him. And so when Grant left, was basically, you know, like cast away, like, you're dead to me. And then Grant goes on to open Alinea and basically become, at this, I mean, Alinea's like, I mean, Alinea's up there in age now. I mean, I think that like Grant may, you know, he has the potential to run a 3-Michelin-star restaurant of extreme prestige. I mean, one of the top restaurants in the world. He might hit, you know, the same amount of time as Trotter. I mean, he's definitely on that path. So Alinea's early years were kind of eclipsing Trotter's later years. So you really watched Chicago, and the trends were changing. Trotter's felt, or it felt like over the top. It felt like ornate and kind of, I don't know, almost like opulent, like a dated and opulent, where Alinea was like slick and crisp and like, and stark and really, really, it was the shifting of the trends.
Did that affect him?
Absolutely. I mean, yes, it did. I mean, it really, the media shifting their attention away from Charlie towards Grant was a hard blow for him. And then like John mentioned, I remember that vividly now, getting 2 stars and Grant got 3. And that was basically, I mean, that was the nail in the coffin for, I mean, actually no pun intended, but obviously Charlie died relatively soon after he closed his restaurant.
It was under 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, it was and he was not well. I mean, you can watch his physical change. It was sad. I mean, I remember it in real time because I think I ate there in 05 or 06.
And that was a big deal for you.
It was a huge deal. I think I was 21 or 22, and I had a tasting menu, and I had, you know, I mean, we had multiple extra courses and gift bags. We didn't announce ourselves, but they just know your industry. Like, they just, you know, they were just, they had a whole team of, the front of house was incredible. I mean, I haven't really had a lot of meals that have lived up to it since. I mean, but it was because it was my first real, I mean, I think I had a tribute with Tekashi back in like early 2000s,
oh, okay.
But it was like my first time ever having a, oh my God, experience. I mean, paying your rent equivalent for dinner at that time was like, what, you know, what is even happening?
We'll be right back right after this. John, when you came back to Detroit after having spent that time there, I mean, your confidence must have been in a place where it wouldn't have been after working for him.
Yeah,
did you feel like I'm ready to do my own thing, or at least work at such a high level?
I knew I wasn't ready to do my own thing for sure. Because I would have been somewhere right around 25, I guess, when I was done, 24, 25. And you know, I knew the goal was to come back here. So I was still, I felt like my experience was, I mean, it was incredible and it changed everything about the way I operate. But I knew that it wasn't realistic. I knew I wasn't going to do a restaurant like that. And I wasn't going to have, you know, the tweezers and all this fancy stuff.
Right.
You know, and we'd certainly use a lot of techniques and things from that era and that time. But it was just so different, you know, because to me, it's always been about like, I want to feed as many people and as sprawling of a diverse group of people that I can. And, you know, when you're charging that, like, you, I don't know, you just hope for the best that you're like going to make it and people are wanting to spend that. Otherwise, you're in a whole lot of trouble.
Yeah, but you after Trotter's, you went and worked for Matthias, and those concepts were much more similar to Grego's.
I got around after that. So I would say when I left, I was motivated and had the ego to say, like, I just went through, you know, 3.5 years of boot camp.
Right.
And like, so I had to come out of there with the expectations and the way that the restaurant and the kitchen would function. So I took that to the next place with me, and, you know, it was a slap in the face of reality shortly after that. That just, you know, the stark contrast of styles of restaurants. But yeah, I got to work for a lot of people. It almost appeared as though I was just chasing celebrity chefs, which I wasn't at all. But after I left there, I worked for the director of operations of this Art Smith company, and she oversaw Table 52, but she was Charlie's assistant.
Art Smith, you may know, is Oprah's. He's famous for being Oprah's chef. He obviously is a restaurateur as well. He's not just like Oprah's chef, but she kind of was. She kind of gave him that big boost.
Right. Definitely. Yeah. She got him out there. He was on the air and got the two books and all that good stuff. Yeah. So yeah. And then I left there and I worked for Graham Elliott, who's now who knows what cooking show he's
you know, Graham Elliott kind of has the white glasses
the white glasses guy sure. And then after that I moved or went back with
the Graham Elliott. That was a pretty edgy restaurant in Chicago. That was a pretty like, that was hip. I mean, that was the spot.
I thought it was the coolest because it was doing what Charlie had, you know, that we were doing there, but in like new modern hip area. And it was like, you know, they were wearing t-shirts, which is cool. Actually, no, first they started with short sleeve chef coats, which I thought was awesome because we were wearing the toque. We had these paper toques we had to wear.
Wearing trotters.
Yeah. And it was like foot and a half tall. And yeah, I'm a short guy, so I don't factor in a lot of clearance when I'm walking around. But I'd be bashing in that thing. I had so many cuts on the top of my forehead just from the thing just digging in. And you know, I can get warm, let's say, especially in that kitchen at Trotters. And like, this thing's made from paper. And you know, you don't want to be looking nasty because there's people sitting in the kitchen. And of course, obviously you're handling food. So I was just, you know, I needed a sweatband, but all I had was this piece of paper. Oh God, disgusting. Anyway, good time. So I'd switch out. I'd go through like six of those hats a day.
Wow.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, we would go all the way till, you know, well, my dynamic was I would work at the catering company or the store until 8 o'clock we'd close. I'd be done by 9 o'clock and I would drive to the restaurant for the second service because I only did two seating, 6 o'clock, 9 o'clock. So then I would just go over there and I would jump into service and the menu changed every day, which you know a little bit about, James. And I didn't work there during the day. So I didn't have any clue what was happening. And it wasn't like they were like sending me an email because it probably would have needed to have been a fax at that time. But, you know, it was, I just jump in and like, you don't want to look like you don't know what you're doing. You definitely don't want to get in anybody's way because everyone's like, it was still this era where I'm like, I'm going to step on you to get above you. Mm-hmm. And not always, but everyone was, you know, it was the best showing up there. So it was like, if you got the job, you were so eager to prove how good you were so that you could, you know, either move up the ranks or just fuel your own ego. So you would get a fair amount of that. They wouldn't even waste their time learning your name for like 6 months because most people just wouldn't make it. So,
and then after Graham Elliott, you go to Matthias.
Then I go back and open up.
And what restaurants were you at the time?
We did Billy Sunday.
Which is still there.
Still there. Real cool. You Show, which is no longer an untimely demise. And then another You Show. And then we also opened a spot called A10, which was like
A10's still there, right?
No. Okay. Well, the restaurant is, but it's under a different name, ownership. Crushing the game. But yeah, it closed, three years after I left.
So. And so originally you mentioned Matthias. You kind of were thinking about Matthias being your partner in Grey Ghost. You had approached him first. He said no.
Yeah.
And then you come back and you do it.
They did not, which, you know, I get it. The outside perception of the city of Detroit, while it's flourishing now in some minds, it still struggles in others. And, you know, this was 2014, I guess, that I would have started the process of dreaming this thing up and feeling like I could just take the plunge. And I thought that'd be the easiest route is I could get them to join in and then I could still, because I also was like, loved Chicago, you know, Chicago guy for 14 years. So I thought I could, you know, have the connection. And, you know, my last position or role there was director of culinary operations. So I was overseeing all of them. So I'm like, okay, I'd spend a week in Detroit, see the fam, run the restaurant, come back to Chicago. Anyway, they said it was a bad idea. So
and that's interesting because, you know, I feel like to me when Because, yeah, I mean, it would be plug and play, right? They got the infrastructure, got the payroll team, yeah. the HR. You just open up another unit instead of, like, starting from zero.
Exactly.
So I get inspired when somebody kind of, like, they kind of are basically saying, like, it's a bad idea. You have a bad idea. So that were you, does that motivate you more?
Definitely. Yeah. And it was tricky because he was my mentor, so I didn't want to, you know, rock the boat. I was terrified to leave, and I was bringing my now partner, Chef Joe Giacomino, with me.
So he came out of the group,
he
too.
He was working in the group, yeah, because I brought him in there.
So the top guy and then the top guy.
And we had to quit together because I didn't want to lie to my mentor. So I'm like, I have to, you know, he's going to ask me about you because he knows we're, you know, I brought you in here and we're best friends. So we just quit together. And I don't know if that was the best.
That hurts. As an employer,
Yeah, for sure. But it was just like, you know, and I think there was a level of understanding or whatever, an acceptance, especially from Matthias, because he was working with chefs that were like leaving to go run their own restaurants.
Well,
I think you
basically gave him the opportunity. It's like, hey.
Yeah, hey, definitely. Like, let's do this
or I'm going to go do it.
Yep.
Right, first refusal.
So yeah. Gregos opens in July of 16.
Yep.
And I mean, pretty much I don't want to blow your ego up here, but pretty much a success out of the gate.
It was good. Yeah, you know? For sure.
I mean, like, I feel like you were well received in the city. I think the fact that you're from Michigan is a huge bonus. It's always a little tough, I feel like, to be an out of towner trying to open a business here. There's definitely, we love the hometown heroes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why I didn't emphasize my time in Chicago, because I knew how passionate people were about Detroit. And I'm like, you know, we're coming back, and like, if we're like, hey, we're these chefs from Chicago, but to show you how it's done, Detroit, you know? And I was like, no. And I was also very conscientious to ensure that nowhere in any press release did it say that I was like from Detroit, because I knew like I'm gonna get eaten up for that, because they're gonna see me and they're like, this guy didn't come from the city, he's from the burbs. So I made sure that everything said Metro Detroit. And then we did like, I don't know, we did 9 pop-ups, I think, and like 4 or 5 charitable events in the year while we were building the restaurant,
which is great.
Yeah, because I wanted people to know like we're part of this community. I came from here.
We're here.
I'm back here to do this thing. Please don't think we're just carpetbagging, popping in here, going to take your money because we think we're big time.
What I think is so smart too, which that you did, is that you opened up a brand. Gregos is a brand, right? Some people go to Gregos and don't even know who the hell you are. And that's good. Like, you know, Charlie Trotter is the complete opposite. People, if they go there, they expect to see him. And if they don't, then they're like, this is not worth it. I mean, chef, like the idea of naming your restaurant after yourself, which plenty of chefs do. I think look at Gordon Ramsay in London. I think is year 21 of 3 Michelin stars. I mean, but you know, the guy's like jumping out of airplanes. You know, he's not in that kitchen.
Definitely not.
But I think that like you did a great job of opening up a brand that people can, you know, maybe you're a cocktail fan and you're there for the bar program, or you're there for late night burger, whatever, or you're there for a, you know, multi-course experience with your family, anniversary. You created a brand that isn't so reliant on yourself, which is interesting because you spend so much time working for chefs that name their restaurants after themselves. You did the complete opposite, which is, you know, I think it's a, you know, similar to your personality. You're a very humble guy. You're not really concerned with the spotlight too much. So good on you. That was a good business decision. Yeah.
But you know, because I was working for all these celebrity chefs and stuff, you know, they weren't there. Right?
Yeah.
Just like you mentioned. So, you know, they were there, but they weren't there. And like, you didn't have a rapport, right? I had a rapport with my direct people that I was reporting to. And so you grow dedicated to them. But then when you look at it, you're like, all right, well, I love these people, but like the company, like,
you know?
So I didn't ever want that to be the case. And it was like, also, restaurants aren't that great of investment. So it's like, you don't open it because you're going to make money. You know, you open it because you want to be there. I want to serve the people. Yeah. I'm not just looking for the paycheck, because I'm still looking.
And now we have 3 restaurants. We have Second Best, which is, you know, a bar, restaurant / right? Mostly bar probably. I'm not trying to dig into your sales, but I assume
you
probably lead with, bar. It's a bar, yeah, bar with wrong. Food. And then Basan, full scale restaurant, big, beautiful restaurant. And then Grey Ghost obviously is kind of your flagship. Is there anything else in the pipeline?
Well, I don't see any reason to stop now. You know, the tricky part is that dreamt always of owning my own restaurant, but I never got past that part, you know? So like now like, yeah, I always want to, you know, I'm going to open my own restaurant. And I feel like every chef says that, you know, throughout the course of their career. Super vindicating when you actually do it. And the number of like my former cooks that were like, hell yeah, you did it. Like you said you were going to do it. And, you know, this was like people that worked for me 10 years prior to us opening Gregos, because it was like, this is going to happen.
Yeah. You manifested.
So, yeah. So we put it out there. We got it done. So.
Well, I think you do an incredible job. I'm a big fan. You know, I'm a little hurt. You called Joe your best friend, but that was.
Oh, you got multiple best friends. 2023, you got to have multiple best friends. Yeah.
But yeah, no. I mean, thank you for coming on the show with us and for sharing your stories. It definitely, I'm sure there's a million more. And,
oh, we could have three more shows about that.
But no, great job. We're, Detroit is lucky to have you. Three awesome restaurants. Appreciate your time.
Appreciate it.
We would like to thank you for listening. Essential Cooking is produced by me and Alisi, along with my co-host, Chef James Regatto. This episode was also produced, engineered, edited, and mastered by Connor Anderson, with production support from David Lyons. Original music by the Mallet Brothers. Essential Cooking is a production of WDET's public radio station.